Over to Michelle Mahoney to officially begin today's webinar.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean, for the introduction there. I really appreciate it. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. I think we have a really great presentation today. I want to just share with you some other resources that are available related to mining that EPA compiles. We do have a mining site focus area on Cluin.org where we update very regularly with new research and information related to cleanup technologies and reuse of contaminated mining sites. So I wanted to share that with everyone and make sure they were aware of that. And also wanted to make you aware that the webinar that you are participating in today is part of a series that we've been doing for quite a few years now, and there are a number of archive webinars that we've done in the past that you can view at any time if you want to learn about some of the other topics that we've presented. And with that, I'm going to introduce today's two speakers, which we're really glad to have today. We have B.T. Thomas and Jim Bays, who are both with Jacobs. B.T. Thomas, as you can see on the screen here, has a lot of experience as a project geochemist, working on the treatment of acid rock drainage and specializing in passive treatment systems for mine-impacted water. So we're very excited to have him today to talk about this subject with us. And then Jim Bays is a professional wetland scientist and a fellow in natural treatment systems with Jacobs, and he has over 40 years of experience specializing in the planning and design of natural treatment systems for water quality improvement. So we're really glad to have them sharing their expertise with us today on this webinar. And just as an overview, they're going to talk about the background, history, and principles on the use of biochemical reactors to treat mine-impacted water. I'm not going to go into all of the details on this slide because I'm sure they're going to share a lot of them with you. But again, I want to thank them both for being here and sharing their knowledge with us. And this will become one of the archive webinars in our series that I mentioned. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our speakers.
Jim, are you with us on the phone?
Yes, I'm here, and I'm ready to start. So I guess we'll get going here. Well, thanks for the opportunity to present today. Today we're talking about the long-term performance of biochemical reactors for passive treatment of mine-impacted water. And I wanted to just start off with a safety moment like most companies do these days. Many of us find ourselves working in remote areas or out in the woods on passive treatment projects or with any project. As with any job, there's always hazards. In the eastern U.S., venomous snakes are always something to watch for in the eastern side of the U.S., and particularly working in the field in the springtime when snakes are becoming active here. So snakes are often actually camouflaged, and we wanted to ask if you can see the copperhead in this picture. And if we highlight that, you'll see him highlighted here. He's well camouflaged and disguised. And it's a hazard that everybody should be keeping in mind when they're actually working in the field. If you're in the eastern part of the U.S., one of the things that should happen, of course, is in preparing field safety plans, the plan needs to keep in mind that there's a potential for this, and be careful when working in areas where there's woody debris or making sure you watch where you place your hands and feet when walking. So just a caution for everybody working in the field. All right, so I wanted to get going here with an outline. What we'll show here is the background, first, of passive treatment technologies and how they can be configured. We'll dive then into biochemical reactors as a component technology, another form of passive treatment of mine-impacted water. BT will go over that in detail. Then we'll focus on two examples of biochemical reactor projects where we have collaborated with our clients on design and where we have had the benefit of receiving follow-up data summaries and observations by the site manager. I will go over the major findings of a selenium treatment biochemical reactor passive treatment system for a coal company in southern West Virginia, and BT will go over the history, design, and findings of a passive treatment system in Oklahoma. These projects have allowed us an opportunity to track performance directly and draw conclusions on the merits of using biochemical reactors for improving water quality. We've selected them because they've been in operation long enough for us to address the question of longevity, and that is, you know, how long will these systems work? We'll conclude with a summary of key points and look forward to discussing and responding to any questions. So first, we'll start off with a definition of natural treatment systems. Natural treatment is a low-maintenance method of treating mine-impacted water that does not require continual chemical addition and monitoring and relies on passive biological and chemical processes occurring at their natural rates. The history of natural treatment is drawn from simple observations made 30 or more years ago from natural wetlands receiving water from mines and noting that water quality was improved through passive biological and chemical actions. This has led to a significant effort over the past few decades to isolate and optimize through design those parts of wetlands, such as the sediments or open water, that naturally perform functions of biological, physical, or chemical treatment. We now have a host of tools that mimic the functions of natural systems, such as wetlands and their components. Where feasible, natural treatment systems provide a lower cost solutions and for treating mine-impacted water and a wide range of industrial waters. The advantages over an active treatment system can include, where feasible, that there are substantially lower construction and operating costs, low maintenance, no or limited use of power and chemicals, limited health and safety risks, and can be installed in remote locations. They're applied at mine sites through the design and construction of engineered passive treatment systems. The use of passive treatment systems is typically viewed as a sustainable approach to water quality management. Sustainable approaches typically address environmental effects, economic benefits, and social needs, or the triple bottom line. Where feasible, the use of natural materials and emphasis on reducing water and energy use while utilizing mine land and topography to accomplish the treatment can minimize environmental effects of treatment and lessen the carbon footprint of a project. This approach can be assessed through ranking systems such as Envision, shown here. The use of natural treatment systems can influence sustainability rankings significantly. Natural systems utilize the same chemical and biological processes for treatment as conventional systems. Where conventional systems build tank-based treatment reactors of concrete, steel, and move water and add compounds using electricity and chemicals, natural treatment systems are typically land-based systems that rely upon gravity flow and locally available sustainable substrates to provide the media and biological habitat that sustains these processes at natural rates. As a result, fewer staff are required to operate, and time in the field, maintenance, and monitoring processes are reduced significantly, and fewer residuals are produced. The trade-off here is often whether there is sufficient land to provide treatment, since natural systems require area and time for treatment. With mine-impacted waters, the production of residuals also, for example, iron precipitate, can be at such a rate that there is not enough area or volume for processing and storing naturally. It's also true that mine water issues are related to relatively small flows commonly. This makes passive treatment at least an option to consider. Passive treatment capital and O&M costs are typically lower than active treatment where feasible. This figure shows capital and O&M costs for real-world examples of acid mine drainage systems and selenium treatment systems as a proportion of active costs. Literature and experience tells us that passive treatment may cost one-fourth of the cost of active treatment to build. Operations are less expensive, too, ranging from approximately 10% to 40% of active treatment. The natural treatment toolbox, as we call it, now spans a spectrum of upland to wetlands ecosystems engineered to achieve the project water quality objectives. Our starting perspective is that with any water quality issue, there is probably a natural treatment system that can mimic nature that can be applied to solve the problem. That includes a range of possibilities, shown here, for example, from left to right. That includes upland systems, such as land application or engineered plant uptake systems, to reduce to surface flow and subsurface flow wetlands, to passive media beds, such as anaerobic biochemical reactors, and to ponds, which may be enhanced with floating wetlands or aeration systems. These types of systems and the benefits they bring can be reviewed and compared to see whether any one of them fit the environmental setting of the project. For this presentation, we're focusing on biochemical reactors. Their history as a technology is drawn from observations of natural systems, and particularly how they process metals and sediments in the underlying aquifer and soil materials. Another concept we want to introduce while we're going through the introduction here is that the BCR is rarely implemented as a single unit treatment process. Instead, as we show in our examples, passive treatment systems employ one or more types of systems in a series or treatment train to complement the BCR treatment. This may include a sedimentation basin for precipitate formation and settling, followed by a biological transformation step using a BCR, and the final conditioning or polishing step to remove residuals produced by the biological process. This rationale is based upon the idea of the unit process approach. A second rationale for developing a sequence of systems is to compartmentalize flow. This means that a system could be divided into smaller systems primarily to improve the hydraulics and prevent short-circuiting. Treatment wetlands typically function as a series of well-mixed tanks in series and can be modeled as such. The final consideration is operational, where there may be a need to route flows from one unit to another parallel treatment train to allow access for maintenance or other reasons. Together, this integrated passive treatment concept can provide effective treatment. Stepping back a bit further, the treatment train concept can be expanded to include multiple treatment processes as a system, with the idea that each component will have unique process maintenance requirements. Typically, an initial equalization step helps to balance and reduce peak loading. That can be followed by a primary treatment process for mine waters. This would be something like a sedimentation pond. Following that step, and kind of shown here, kind of obscured by the blue figure, is a biological treatment, which is commonly implemented. This can be a biochemical reactor. A tertiary treatment process would be the third step, and that would be required to condition the water for discharge. This typically includes passive filter media beds, wetlands, or ponds. This concept includes the understanding that the treatment media will itself require replacement or regeneration. This process perspective is appropriate for both passive and active forms of treatment, and this may mean periodic replacement of media. The big question always is how often and at what cost. So now I'll hand it over to BT for his overview on water quality and the biochemical reactors.
Thanks, Jim. Since we're focusing on mine water for this presentation, the figure on the left demonstrates the many sources of impacted water that can be found at mine sites. This includes surface drainage from pit lakes, mine adits, and waste rock piles to groundwater seeps and leachate, all of which may be impacted by metal loading, acidity, elevated sulfate, and other substances such as nitrogen compounds. The potential for water quality impacts varies widely for these types of waters, and they are typically impacted by multiple contaminants. Rarely is a single pollutant all that requires treatment at a mine site. The description of the mine water pollutant environment can be generalized more broadly to other industrial sources, such as manufacturing or power. These facilities can generate processed wastewaters and concentrates similar to mine impacted water that can impact site stormwater. Whether generated at a mine site or an industrial facility, all of these waters tend to have metals and inorganic ions that occur at concentrations significantly above background and or may exceed water quality criteria. Finally, the flow and timing of these waters are typically in ranges beyond what may naturally occur, thus requiring management. This wide range of water types will require different approaches to treatment based upon their water chemistry. From the perspective of applying biochemical reactors appropriately, we may make two distinctions in water chemistry. First, constituents such as iron and aluminum that can form oxyhydroxide precipitates will require a step to allow for hydrolysis and precipitation before flowing to a BCR. These precipitates can clog or reduce longevity of the BCR substrate if not removed in a pretreatment unit. This pretreatment unit is primarily abiotic in nature, and while iron and aluminum are removed during pretreatment, manganese-bearing waters, which also may form oxyhydroxide precipitates, will typically pass through an organic BCR and is treated by a post-BCR process. The second type of water that does not include oxyhydroxide-bearing components and does not require a chemical pretreatment. However, some degree of sedimentation may be required for total suspended solids removal if organic solids are part of the water treatment system. So at this stage in the development of passive treatment technologies, there have been many projects completed by our firm and others that have demonstrated that passive treatment is an effective method of improving water quality. This figure shows the familiar periodic table of elements with colors that show elements known to be treatable through anaerobic reduction in dark blue and through oxidation and precipitation in orange. What is striking about this chart is that you can see that experience with most metals show that they are treatable anaerobically with biological reduction, in other words, with biochemical reactors. This is why we have built our case studies around the BCR concept, and they are effective and they're space efficient. Also, some contaminants such as arsenic can be treated through either oxidation or anaerobic reduction, with the best approach being dependent on site-specific conditions. Finally, many salts, such as chloride, shown in light blue, are environmentally conservative and not treatable directly by passive treatment. In these cases, active treatment or dilution are common approaches. So now that we've introduced the idea of precipitate-bearing water and the wide range of water types that may be encountered, we want to return to the idea of the passive treatment system toolbox. Designers can take different passive treatment units or tools from their passive treatment toolbox to build a system unique to each water chemistry and site condition. For mine and industrial waters, the toolbox is divided into two main categories, either abiotic or geochemically based units or biological treatment units. The abiotic units are often used as pretreatment tools to biologically based units. They're commonly limestone-based and designed on abiotic geochemical reactions, such as how much acidity can be neutralized per unit area per day. The typical goal of these abiotic units is to raise pH, add alkalinity, and or neutralize and reduce stored metal acidity. This typically results in precipitation and removal of iron and aluminum. The biologically based units are engineered to promote either anaerobic biological activity that results in the precipitation of metal sulfides or the transformation to elemental forms, or aerobic units used for polishing secondary parameters such as excess biological oxygen demand, color, and sulfide. Because these biological units rely upon hydraulic residence time of one or more days, they can be the largest units in a passive treatment design. One of the main concerns regarding any biological treatment is year-round operation in cold climate conditions. The biologically based units can be insulated using treatment media and soil to permit year-round operation in extremely cold environments. So now I want to turn specifically to the anaerobically based systems and ask, what is a biochemical reactor? A typical biochemical reactor consists of a compostable organic layer overlying a subsurface drain to create a vertical flow of water through the substrate and a water control structure to keep the organic layer flooded, thereby promoting and maintaining anoxic conditions. The media is typically designed using locally available and sustainable materials to supply long-term carbon and minimize permeability loss. These systems are designed to last anywhere from 10 to 20 years. And we're going to get into longevity as this talk proceeds. So due to the high carbon content and the anaerobic nature of the biochemical reactor, the effluent tends to contain elevated biological oxygen demand, color, and excess sulfide with no dissolved oxygen. As such, biochemical reactors are designed and constructed with an accompanying aerobic polishing cell, or an APC, that is designed to remove the biologic oxygen demand and color, oxidize any residual sulfide, and raise the dissolved oxygen to the final effluent. The aerobic polishing cells can be either fill-and-drain gravel bed units that operate by solely filling and then rapidly draining, surface flow wetlands, or some combination of both. Although biologically based, both biochemical reactors and aerobic polishing cells can effectively be operated in cold climates by simply burying and insulating the unit. So bioreactors are typically constructed using locally available, readily composted organic materials, such as wood chips and sawdust, hay, peat, limestone sand, and manure. Only biologically based media recipes were very simple, typically consisting of one or maybe two components, such as spent mushroom compost or simply hay. However, the inability of the media to buffer the influence of acid load, and thereby stressing the microbial community, and early hydraulic failure of the substrate have resulted in more complex recipes with multiple components. Wood chips are typically added to provide long-term structural support to the substrate as the more readily degradable products start to break down, thereby maintaining the hydraulic integrity of the substrate for a longer time frame. Manure is typically added in very small amounts to provide a microbial seed to the substrate. However, large amounts of manure are avoided to minimize excessive biological oxygen demand following startup. Limestone sand is added to help buffer the substrate to near-neutral conditions. Peat and sawdust are added to create high reactive surface area for microbial attachment. Things like solar and wind power can be used to enhance aeration in the downstream neighborhood of polishing cell when space is limited. Typically, all flow is by gravity. There are no chemical or fossil fuel inputs into the system. So how do they work? Biochemical reactors are designed to support elemental reducing microorganisms. For the majority of the system, this means sulfate reduction to generate sulfide, which in turn can react to precipitate trace metals from solution. However, biochemical reactors can also be designed specifically to reduce other elements that impact water quality. For example, selenium, chromium, or even uranium can be biologically reduced, resulting in the direct precipitation of these metals in the DPR substrate. Because these units are biologically based, they typically require longer residence time than other passive treatment units. On average, the hydrologic residence time of a typical biochemical reactor is on the order of 1 to 4 days, but could be significantly longer. Biochemical reactors are designed based on empirically based loading models for the main contaminant of concern and are sized to handle the largest flow and under the coldest temperatures expected. As noted previously, hydrolyzable metals such as iron or aluminum should be removed in pretreatment passive units to maximize the longevity of the BCR unit. If these metals are not removed in advance of BCR treatment, they can form oxyhydroxide precipitates within the BCR pore space, effectively clogging the unit and rendering it ineffective. So while biochemical reactors are designed with the intent of supporting a specific microbial process such as sulfate reduction or selenium reduction, the reality is that bioreactors host a consortium of different anaerobic microbial communities that utilize different terminal electron acceptors and compete for the organic substrate. Typical electron acceptors utilized by microorganisms are oxygen, nitrate, ferric iron, sulfate, and carbon dioxide. Microbes tend to oxidize organic substrates by using the electron acceptor that provides the most energy. The electron tower relates to the amount of energy a given microbe population can gain from an electron acceptor. For example, oxygen, which is at the top of the electron tower, provides microbes with more free energy via oxygen reduction than any other electron acceptor. Carbon dioxide, which is used as the electron acceptor by methanogens, yields the least energy of all the electron acceptors and is therefore located at the bottom of the tower. Thus, the electron tower schematically depicts the order of electron acceptors, electron acceptor utilization based on the free energy of any given microbial population can gain from reduction of a given electron acceptor. For example, a BCR influent water with a high nitrate load, the denitrifying bacteria will outcompete the sulfate reducers until all the nitrate is reduced because denitrification is higher in the electron tower than sulfate reduction. So the nitrate load must be considered along with the metal loading for sizing of the BCR during design. So if we turn to the actual history of biochemical reactors, the concept of using sulfate reduction for mine drainage abatement dates back to the late 1960s. With the seminal paper by Tuttle and others. They found that a community of microorganisms broke down compostable organic matter to small chain organic acids that were then utilized by sulfate-reducing bacteria. The sulfate reducers, in turn, generated sulfide and alkalinity, which neutralized mine drainage and precipitated metals from solution. In the early 1980s, bioreactors started being used for denitrification of agricultural runoff. Researchers found that simple wood chip beds could rapidly reduce nitrate in effluent from agricultural tile drainage fields. Several early bioreactors for the treatment of mine drainage, originally called sulfate-reducing bioreactors, or SRBRs, were tested in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The bioreactor pilot study at the Big Five Tunnels in Colorado led to the publication of a bioreactor design manual by Wildman and others in 1993. Other bioreactors, such as the Forest Queen in Silverton, Colorado, which was built in 1998, and the Trail near Helena, Montana, which was built in 2002, have been operated seasonally, but have not been extensively studied. And finally, in 2012, the ICRC published a guidance document for BCR design and operation, and it includes several case studies, one of which we'll talk about here shortly. So some of the earliest bioreactors were built in the early 1980s for denitrification of agricultural runoff. They were mainly wood chip based and have a long track record in the Midwestern U.S. Because nitrate reduction is so rapid, these early bioreactors were able to achieve between 2 to 18 grams of nitrate reduced per cubic meter of substrate per day at residence times on the order of only a few hours. Moorman and others evaluated the carbon availability in these nitrogen bioreactors in 2008. They found that under aerobic conditions, the wood chip bioreactors had a carbon half-life of about 4.5 years, but under anaerobic conditions, they estimated the half-life of the carbon content in the bioreactor beyond the order of about 37 years, suggesting that an anaerobic bioreactor can operate for decades before running out of carbon. So what are the factors that affect the lifespan of a biochemical reactor? How do we get at the longevity of these systems? And this segues this topic of Moorman 2008 segues us into the topic of substrate longevity and the factors affecting longevity. Experience and study tells us that two common factors that warrant consideration include carbon depletion and hydraulic conductivity decline. For carbon depletion, Moorman and others demonstrated that the carbon supply in a typical bioreactor will potentially last decades, and there is no published record of a denitrifying bioreactor depleting the carbon. Reasoning for carbon depletion could be possibly attributed to inadequate sizing or the wrong carbon source. The published experience doesn't exist that shows a BCR, for mining anyway, wearing out, although in our experience we've seen occasion for pilot projects may be depleted of carbon if carried out well past their design life. In general, though, the expectation is that anaerobic substrates will last a long time because they decompose at a much slower rate than the aerobic substrates. Perhaps a more significant planning factor considers the loss of hydraulic properties of the BCR substrate over time. Plugging due to inorganic solids accumulation, media consolidation through aging, or simply in situ precipitation of metals can all impact the hydraulic conductivity of the substrate. Several steps can be taken to minimize these potential hydraulic concerns over the long-term performance of the BCR life. Pre-treatment should be used to remove suspended solids. BCR substrate recipes should include a more heterogeneous mix of materials, including wood chips or even gravel. And if in situ precipitation is a major concern, the BCR process units can be broken down into smaller, more manageable units that can be operated in parallel to allow for future maintenance. Finally, fluffing of the BCR substrate may be a solution if hydraulic conductivity does decline over the life of the system, and we'll talk about that in one of our case studies. So now we're going to get into two case studies that focus on BCR processes and longevity. The first case study that Jim is going to cover is the Colmax Selenium Treatment System in southern West Virginia. It's been operating for approximately 8 years continuously with compliant operation. The overall annual O&M cost is around $5,000 per year. Our second case study, which I'll cover, is the Mare Ranch Passive Treatment System. It's been operating for a little over 10 and a half years of continuous effective operation. Its annual R&M cost is approximately $10,000, and it's had one maintenance, quote-unquote, event after 8 years to rejuvenate the BCR substrate hydraulics at a cost of about $4,000. And we will talk about that when we get to the case study two. All right, I'm going to hand it over to Jim, and he's going to take you through case study one.
All right, BT. Well, the first example here extends in the from the coal mining country of southern West Virginia, beginning in the late 2000s. At that time, water quality standards were enacted to limit the selenium in surface water discharges to 4.7 micrograms per liter as a monthly average and 8.2 micrograms per liter as a daily max. This was an obvious concern to the mining companies. The selenium was found commonly in the drainage from valley fills, which are the waste rock repositories used in surface mines. The exposed rock often included marine shales near coal seams, and selenium in the rock was being oxidized when in contact with air and mobilized by infiltrating rainfall. The form of selenium in this case is mostly typically selenate, SeO4, which is mobile and a contaminant of concern over its bioaccumulation and toxic potential. Our coal mining company here had two outlets with selenium concentrations higher than the standard. So as part of our series of work that we did, we conducted a pilot study in 2010 and developed sizing criteria for sizing a treatment system. We then designed full-scale treatment systems and commented on their construction and helped in that regard. The systems were built and began operating in 2011. The working principles behind passive treatment of selenium is based on the understanding that selenium exists in the multiple oxidation states, and that this condition is biologically mediated. By creating an anaerobic treatment environment, the microbial community converts selenium through the process of dissimulatory reduction. This process has been demonstrated to occur in natural and constructed wetlands, so much of the understanding we have on selenium treatment in these kind of systems is founded on studies in wetlands. This process occurs over several weeks in wetlands, but in biochemical reactors, it's a rapid process occurring in 1 to 2 days or less. Other removal processes are at work in anaerobic sediments. Some selenium is sorbed, particularly in the selenite form, where it can sorb to iron or aluminum oxides or hydroxides in the water, in the media, and organic media, matter surfaces. Some selenium is volatilized as a gaseous form of selenide, and this has been shown to be a significant loss factor in wetlands. Plants themselves, when present, will take up selenium and store it in plant tissue. However, given the potential for ecological exposure of wildlife to bioaccumulation in materials in wetlands receiving selenium, the approach we and others have taken is to reduce that potential to significant levels using bioreactors. Pilot study tested four different recipes of compostable organic media in an anaerobic upflow barrel system using the local water on site. The media types ranged from peat just by itself to several mixtures of organic media that included wood chips, sawdust, hay, peat, composted manure, and limestone chips. These types varied in proportions of the wood chips and manure as the largest component. The results showed that the media mix reduced selenium by 90% from 23 micrograms per liter and readily achieving the 4.7 microgram per liter standard. The peat mixture also removed selenium, but to a lesser extent, and we believe is a removal process largely of sorption for that type of system. The results of the pilot tests were reduced further to removal rates used to calibrate several types of models for sizing. What we found was that the mixed organic media beds showed the greatest removal rates, and all the media types showed increasing removal rates with shorter hydraulic residence times. Also, we saw that an optimal residence time for this water was on the order of 18 hours. This translates to a removal rate of around 26 milligrams of selenium per day per cubic meter of substrate. Because other waters may have higher concentrations of nitrate and nitrogen, removal rates may be different. This site had an average inflow nitrate concentration of 4.7 milligrams per liter. Greater values will yield different removal rates because of the electron competition that BT described earlier. So, based upon these sizing criteria, the system was designed conservatively for a 60 gallon per minute average flow from available flow data. As you can see here, it's a four-cell system. The objective was to treat average concentration of 12 micrograms per liter based on data at the time to less than the water quality standard. The first cell is a 0.13-acre downflow biochemical reactor with 3 feet of mixed organic media topped by 2 feet of water. Flow from that first cell goes and underneath is collected on the bottom of the system and goes underneath the separating berm and up through a layer of peat in the second cell, which provides an anaerobic filtering step for particle capture. The third cell is a 0.16-acre gravel subsurface media bed, which can be operated in fill-and-drain mode by a passive overflow siphon. A final 0.1-acre wetland provides a final level of solids removal. Water samples taken weekly to biweekly over the 8-year period of record show an average inlet concentration of 10 micrograms per liter and an average outlet concentration of 1.2 micrograms per liter. Throughout that period, all daily values have remained below the 8.2 standard, and all monthly values have averaged well below the monthly average criterion of 4.7. We've seen a pattern develop over the years where during late winter and early spring, outlet concentrations increase slightly to 2 to 3 micrograms per liter when flow from melting snow or winter rains are frequent. Outlet selenium concentrations drop to less than a microgram per liter during the summer and autumn, during the lowest flow periods. This pattern now seems stabilized over the past 5 years and likely represents the effects of aerobic waters pulsing into the system during storm events. The continued return to essentially non-detectable levels each year indicates that the system is robust and can respond to changing inflow conditions rapidly. Taking a closer look at the dynamic range of loads, let's see here. Did I do this right? Yeah, thanks. Sorry, there's another one here. The annual temperature range in outflow water varies over 20 degrees centigrade from lowest to highest over the course of the year, but temperature has little effect on outlet selenium concentrations, and any variation is well within the daily maximum limits. We believe that there is a slight response, as I mentioned, typically in late winter and spring. It's closely associated with the timing of winter flows than with, rather than the effect of temperature per se. The colder winter water has a higher saturation content, which has to be assimilated in the biochemical reactor. Taking a closer look at the dynamic range of flows and loads, this figure shows that inflow rates do show the annual cycle I mentioned, with the highest flow rates in blue and loading in green in the winter, springtime period typically. The design hydraulic flow and selenium load were exceeded once during the early years, but no lasting effect to system performance was noted, another indication of the kind of robust, you know, responsive nature of this system. These same data can be plotted as mass loading versus mass removal, shown here. The annual range in flow and loads extends over a range with a maximum almost 10 times greater than the minimum. The removal rates track this trend very closely, consistent with other assessments of treatment performance for natural systems. The figure shows three lines. The top line plots a line of complete removal. The bottom line represents a line that would be just the minimum needed to meet the permit limit. The system is performed right in the middle of that range with a long-term mass removal rate of 80%. This pattern is extended through the life of the system. We've also seen the pilot results we showed earlier matched by the full-scale results in terms of their effects of hydraulic residence time. This figure shows that the removal rate is highest at the lowest hydraulic residence times of 1 day or less. Because flows and the associated load vary so widely, the actual removal rate is lower with greater residence time. This finding indicates the removal process is load-based and that sustained high loads will yield the greatest removal rates. We've had the opportunity to take our barrel pilot systems apart to see where the selenium is being stored and in what form. This figure shows that the selenium is removed and sequestered near to the inlet of the system. We've seen this consistently across all of our pilots, and it indicates that the active treatment processes needed for selenium removal are limited to a relatively narrow depth range. These data indicate that the required removal capacity of a system is much less than what exists in the biochemical reactor. The implication is that the capacity of the system is much greater than the actual size would indicate, and the system will use that additional capacity as time proceeds. Related to the last observation, our speciation studies on the substrate show that the selenium is sequestered in the substrate in reduced forms, either as elemental selenium, which is the blue box on top of the columns, absorbed selenite in light green, or as selenides in red. These findings show that the process happens equally throughout the media column. So stepping back for a minute, one need for any biochemical reactor project is to plan for the need to improve the quality of the bioreactor outflow. Organic color will be present, as well as potentially elemental sulfur, biochemical oxygen demand, and low dissolved oxygen, so additional polishing is needed. This is most pronounced at the startup of a BCR system, but may recur naturally later on. This figure shows a gravity cascade for the discharge from a selenium bioreactor as one such system. For the coal mine example, the polishing system consisted of a peat filter bed, which is cell 2 in this table, and a gravel bed and a wetland, the final effluent. The system reduced BOD and COD significantly through the gravel bed and reduced nitrogen and phosphorus. The figure shows a high clarity of the water coming from the gravel bed effluent. Okay. As a last note on polishing, this figure shows the turbidity treatment from the biochemical reactor at the coal mine. The solid line represents the turbidity from the BCR, which was initially high and remained high for several weeks and then dropped to inlet levels. During this period, the dashed line represents the outflow, pointing out that the post-treatment system removed over 80% of the turbidity and continued to remain low since that began. As a concluding statement on this case study, COLMAC example shows how a natural system proved to be an appropriate solution that balanced and ultimately outweighed the features of a conventional system. We had a limited area to work in, but the size was just large enough for the treatment process to be constructed. The construction cost was less than 10% of the estimated cost of a full-scale equalization pond and membrane treatment system, which was the considered alternate. The operations were budgeted to be much less than for a full-scale system, and in practice have proved to be even less. Based upon this success, COLMAC has proceeded to build a total of 13 biochemical reactors using the same type of integrated passive treatment system as demonstrated by the initial project we've shown here. This includes a biochemical reactor, vertical upflow polishing bed, and a horizontal subsurface flow bed for polishing. So in conclusion, for this case study, the COLMAC project has demonstrated a consistent performance over the life of the project thus far, with no indication of reduced performance or hydraulics or any issues requiring maintenance at all. The O&M costs essentially consist of monitoring. No substrate enhancement, replacement, or adjustment has been necessary. The cost for maintenance is estimated to be very low for treatment, even including the cost of substrate replacement after 20 years or so. This approach to treating selenium has been recognized by the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection as innovative. I'll pass this over to BT now for the second case history.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Our second case study is the Mare Ranch Passive Treatment System that was designed and built in collaboration with our client, Dr. Robert Nairn from the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Nairn, with his students in the Center for Restoration of Ecosystems and Watersheds, otherwise known as CREW, had been studying several artesian discharges of mine pool water for over a decade when the Mare Ranch Passive System was constructed in 2008. These artesian flows were the first subsurface expressions of mine pool discharge after mining stopped and the mine workings were allowed to flood and fill. Water from these artesian flows have been impacting an approximate 200-hectare watershed since 1979. The Mare Ranch system is a prime example of a mine chemistry that requires pretreatment to remove hydrolyzable iron prior to treatment with the BCR. Multiple process units are used to sequentially remove the iron, followed by trace metal constituents found in the mine pool discharge. Bob and his CREW students have continued to maintain and operate the Mare Ranch systems to this day, and all the data presented in this section are credited to our partner, the University of Oklahoma. So the Mayor Ranch property lies within the southeastern portion of the Tartar Creek Superfund site in the northeastern corner of Oklahoma, otherwise known as NEO. The Tartar Creek Superfund site is a portion of the abandoned lead and zinc mining area known as the Tri-State Mining District, which lies along the state lines of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri. The Tartar Creek is one of four Superfund sites within the former Tri-State Lead Zinc Mining District. Mining started in the late 1800s and was mined continuously for almost 70 years. The legacy impacts of lead zinc mining in the area have highly impacted surface water quality. The Tri-State Mining District was a mining megasite that includes six distinct communities and 10 Native American tribes. Underground mining from 1890 through the 1960s degraded over 1,000 surface hectares and left nearly 500 kilometers of tunnels and over 2,600 open shafts and boreholes. Approximately 94 million cubic meters of contaminated water currently exists in underground voids. In 1979, metal-rich water with elevated iron, zinc, cadmium, lead, and arsenic began to discharge into surface water from natural springs, boreholes, and mine shafts. The first known occurrence was observed from two abandoned boreholes on the Mayor Ranch property in Commerce, Oklahoma. In 1983, the Tri-State Mining District was added to the National Priorities List as four distinct Superfund sites. Mayor Ranch falls within the Tartar Creek Superfund site. Starting in 1997, Dr. Nairn and his students and crew began a comprehensive watershed monitoring program that has been running continuously to this day. The average annual mass loading of metals at Mayor Ranch, based on 20 years of data, is only 89,000 kilograms of iron and over 6,000 kilograms of zinc per year. These loadings have been fairly consistent since the Mayor Ranch close started in 1979, which means almost 98 tons of iron and almost 7 tons of zinc per year have been discharged into the Tartar Creek watershed continually for over 30 years before the Mayor Ranch passive treatment system was built. This also means that the Mayor Ranch passive treatment system has removed almost 980 tons of iron and 70 tons of zinc in its first 10 years of operation, as we'll demonstrate in the following slide. So how did the Mayor Ranch passive treatment system evolve? Using the water chemistry data Dr. Nairn and his crew students started collecting in 1997, Bob began to conceptualize a vision for passive treatment at the site. With funding from the EPA, Dr. Nairn was able to take that vision and concept to full-scale design and construction. In partnership with Jacobs, Dr. Nairn and the Jacobs design team was able to fit these concepts into the 3.9 acres available at the site. The main components of this conceptual vision include an oxidation pond to precipitate iron, an aerobic marsh to trap the precipitated solids, a biochemical reactor to remove trace metals, followed by aerobic polishing to re-aerate the effluent from the BCR. Following re-aeration, limestone beds were implemented to remove any residual zinc as a carbonate precipitate, and a final aerobic wetland was added to complete polishing of the water prior to discharge. As we discussed earlier in this presentation, an integrated passive treatment system takes the appropriate tools from the passive treatment toolbox and lays out the components in a logical sequence to manipulate the chemistry in a way that promotes longevity of a healthy, natural system. Bob's vision lays out the principal components of an integrated passive treatment system with the most fundamental concepts of pretreatment before biological treatment in a BCR, followed by the post-treatment of polishing. The Mayor Ranch passive treatment system is designed not only as a treatment system for the mine pool discharge, but also as an ecological engineering field research for the University of Oklahoma. Using funding from the US EPA, design was completed in 2007 and construction was started in June 2008. The system was completed and fully operational by November 2008. It is the first passive treatment system in the entire Tri-State Mining District and has operated continuously for the past 10 and a half years. The system was designed for about 250 gallons per minute inflow, using the six distinct process units from Bob's conceptual design. Following the main oxidation pond, the flow is split into two parallel treatment trains before being recombined in the final polishing unit for a total of 10 treatment cells. The parallel trains include the surface flow or marsh wetlands, the BCR unit, the re-aeration ponds, and the horizontal flow limestone reactor bed. There's been limited annual O&M at the site, with one major O&M event in 2017, which we'll discuss later in the presentation. The system receives elevated concentrations of iron, zinc, lead, cadmium, and arsenic from the artesian mine pool discharge and discharges clean water that meets the receiving stream criteria. So if you look a little bit at the water quality over the past 10 years of Mare Ranch, this chart shows the average water quality changes during the 10 years of operation of the Mare Ranch Pasture Treatment System. The key parameters to point out are iron dropping from 192 milligrams per liter to 130 micrograms per liter on average. Zinc from 11 milligrams per liter to 250 micrograms per liter, and removal of cadmium, lead, and arsenic to below detection limits. Looking more closely at iron removal, we can see that almost all the iron is removed in the pretreatment cell prior to the BCR. The main oxidation pond removes the bulk of the total iron, while the marsh wetland unit, units polish the remaining iron. So here's our inlet, here's our oxidation pond, here's the effluent from the two marsh wetlands. The initial oxidation pond was designed to remove 20 grams of iron per square meter of pond surface per day. And after 10 years, Dr. Nairn and his crew have found that the mean removal rate has been 20.4 plus or minus 5.4 grams of iron removed per square meter per day. Pretty good. Another key observation is that lead, cadmium, and arsenic are all removed to varying degrees through co-precipitation or absorption to the iron oxide solid in the first two operational units. So Bob and his students took samples from the iron oxide in the first two cells. And another observation is that the iron oxides removed in the system become more crystalline and therefore more stable over time. Bob's crew found that the initial precipitation of iron occurs as the amorphous iron oxide ferrihydrite, but with burial and aging, the ferrihydrite recrystallized to a more stable crystalline form of iron oxide known as goethite. The more stable crystalline oxides are preferred for ultimate sludge removal, handling, and disposal. The above two photos are SEM photomicrographs of the iron sludge taken from the surface of the oxidation pond on the left, showing the ferrihydrite, and from cores of the deep iron oxide sludge on the right, showing the more crystalline goethite. Since zinc is the dominant trace metal in the system, we will use it as an example for showing efficiency of the BCR unit. While we see minor zinc removal in the initial oxidation pond here and in the wetland, surface wetlands here, near the BCRs, the main mechanism of zinc removal at the Mare Ranch passive system is through sulfide precipitation in the BCR unit. As part of the BCR design, it was assumed that the BCR unit could generate up to 300 millimoles of sulfide per cubic meter of substrate per day, and the trace metal load of the system was matched to that productivity to come up with the appropriate sizing. Bob and his crew have found that the BCR unit has generated between 200 and 650 millimoles of sulfide per cubic meter per day consistently over the past 10 years, effectively precipitating almost all the trace metals that enter the unit. So taking a closer look at the BCR substrate, the crew found evidence of metal sulfide precipitation within select BCR substrate samples. The SEM photomicrograph on the left shows zinc sulfide colloids, colloidal aggregates attached to the BCR substrate, while the photo on the right shows iron sulfide precipitates. The spherical grain in the top left of the photo here is what is known as a pyrite framboid. While small individual grains dispersed out here are simply aggregates of individual pyrite grains or iron disulfide. Sequential extraction analysis can be used to chemically estimate which mineral forms a particular metal might take within the BCR substrate. Samples of the BCR substrate taken after 2 years of operation and again after 6 years of operation show that most of the metals are present as metal sulfide and that the process improves with age. The one exception is manganese, which is not readily removed as a sulfide in the BCR substrate. So we have our iron and our zinc, our main contaminants. For concern here, you can see that the purple is the sulfide fraction. Manganese, which doesn't really form a sulfide very well in a BCR substrate, is found as either exchangeable or carbonate fraction. And with sequential extractions, that could mean just basically it's weakly bound in the substrate. So looking at removal, and in summary, the main contaminants of concern for the entire Mayor Ranch Massive Treatment System, we find that lead and cadmium are completely removed from the influent water below detection limits, resulting in over 150 kilograms of lead and 30 kilograms of cadmium removed since startup in 2008. 99.8% of the influent iron has been removed, mainly in the initial oxidation pond and associated marsh wetland, for a total of approximately 750 metric tons of iron over the life of the system. While 98.6% of the influent zinc has been removed, mainly in the BCR unit, for a total of 35 metric tons of zinc over the entire life of the system. Other metals of interest include arsenic and cobalt, which are both removed below detection limits in the system. Approximately 0.3 metric tons of arsenic and 0.2 metric tons of cobalt have been removed over the life of the Mayor Ranch Passive Treatment System. 95.5% of the influent nickel is removed for a total of almost 4 metric tons. Since manganese is not a primary contaminant of concern at the Tar Creek Superfund site, the Mayor Ranch system was not designed specifically for manganese removal. As such, only about 31% of the influent manganese is removed from the influent water for a total of approximately 2 metric tons over the life of the system. If manganese was a targeted contaminant, a different treatment approach could have been added to the post-treatment portion of the Mayor Ranch passive treatment design. This final figure shows the changes for the base metal cations through the system. These cations are not typically impacted or not impacted significantly in the case of calcium and magnesium by passive treatment systems, and as such can be used as conservative tracers through the system. The main reason for plotting this is to demonstrate that the removal is not due to dilution, as these base cations change very little through the system. One final comment as I wrap up all the data from Mayor Ranch is that it's very exciting to see this density of data and consistency of data over 2 decades of monitoring in Tar Creek. Dr. Nairn and his students and crew have published new papers on this system almost yearly, and I encourage anyone who's interested in further information on the Mayor Ranch system from either an ecology to even a geochemistry standpoint to look up Dr. Nairn's website and his publication list. So, how long is this system going to last? From a geochemistry standpoint and an influent effluent performance advantage, the Mayor Ranch passive treatment system has performed flawlessly over 10 years. However, it has not been without some hydraulic issues. A clogged pipe in the oxidation pond marsh wetland system had to be removed and replaced, and the substrate in the BCR started showing permeability issues after 8 years of operation. Although the BCR was still removing metals without any noticeable issues after 9 years of operation, the permeability in the BCR substrate had become severely degraded. In a proactive move to try and rejuvenate the BCR substrate permeability, the substrate was flipped or turned using a mini excavator. And you can see in this photo on the left, one of Bob's students out in the BCR pond with the mini excavator flipping the substrate. In order to perform this maintenance task without impacting water treatment, one BCR was isolated, shut off, and drained, while all the water went through the system. All the water of the system went diverted to the other BCR. The substrate in the drained BCR was then flipped to recover the hydraulic properties, and then allowed to refill. Once refilled and operational, The other BCR is shut down and flow diverted, so it can be drained and flipped as well. The ability to maintain flow through the system during a partial shutdown reinforces the efficiency of the parallel treatment train concept. So did it work? The table above shows the hydraulic conductivity measured in the lab on substrate samples taken during construction in 2008. A variety of laboratory and field-based hydraulic conductivity studies were performed in 2016 after 8 years of operation, showing the degradation in hydraulic performance. And then finally, hydraulic conductivity values measured with a falling head field test in 2017, right after the substrate was flipped, is shown at the bottom down here. The hydraulic values measured after substrate flipping show that the maintenance effort almost completely rejuvenated the substrate hydraulic conductivity after 9 years of continuous operation. So how much did this major, quote-unquote, O&M effort in 2017 cost? The BCR substrate flipping was $4,000, while repairs to the piping and the oxidation bond were approximately $4,400, for a total of less than $10,000. Amortizing this amount over the 10 years of operation shows that it costs about $840 per year in quote-unquote major O&M costs. Bob has also estimated his monitoring and regular O&M costs are approximately $10,000 per year. So what are the conclusions, some of the key points in the Mayor Ranch system? In summary, there are several key points that we can be taken away from the Mayor Ranch Pathway Treatment System. The system has had 10 years of consistent performance with no reduction in water quality performance and minimal maintenance to restore hydraulic function. The routine maintenance is land and water-based as opposed to electrical, chemical, or mechanical maintenance, which means that managing for things like burrowing animals, trees growing in the berm, storm damage, and potential vandalism from potential trespassers rather than full maintenance of an active treatment system. Also, Bob has maintained an excellent rapport with the local community who have generally embraced the efforts of the University of Oklahoma to help clean up the area, and as such, the site has had minimal issues with trespassing. Overall, the annual O&M for Mayor Ranch is less than $10,000 per year with major maintenance of less than $1,000 per year over the 10-year life of the project. This equates to an average cost of less than 10 cents per 1,000 gallons of water treated. And as such, Mayor Ranch project has been highlighted in the ITRC BCR guidance document as one of the top BCR success stories. And an overall conclusion for this presentation, we would like to state that if designed and managed properly, biochemical reactors can meet the longevity and performance requirements of natural systems. The main concerns for longevity are carbon depletion and hydraulic conductivity, though there is little current evidence of carbon depletion being the main concern. Both of our case studies presented in this talk and other systems currently operating demonstrate that after a decade of operation, there are no adverse performance trends, no indication of carbon depletion, and no costly substrate replacement, and overall lower costs of operating relative to comparable active treatment systems. The main concern appears to be hydraulic properties of the substrate, and substrate design should be geared towards maintaining long-term hydraulic conductivity. Jim and I would like to thank our collaborating partners in the West Virginia coal mining industry, and in particular Terry Potter with COLMAC. We'd also like to thank Dr. Robert Nairn and the Center for Restoration of Ecosystems and Watersheds, otherwise known as CREW, the University of Oklahoma, and the countless students that have worked in the Mayor Ranch system over the past two decades. Finally, we'd like to thank the engineering, technical, and science staff at Jacobs.
All right, thank you. I think we're getting ready to move on into the Q&A portion for today's session. So I'll just remind the audience, if you haven't done so already, there's a Q&A window in the bottom right corner of your screen that you can use to privately send in your questions and comments for the speakers. I believe we're going to turn things over to Michelle Mahoney, who will start reading through some of the questions and comments that have come in.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, BT and Jim, for an excellent presentation. We did get a lot of interest with some questions while you were speaking. I think the first one I want to ask you, we got two questions related to climate. One is more general, the other one's more specific about one of the sites, so I'll read both of those to you. The first one wanted to know just about the microbes and in the BCR climate, like what's their sensitivity to the climate? Do the microbes behave differently in a cold versus a warmer climate? And then more specifically, someone wanted to know about the ambient temperature range at the COLMAC site.
Well, sure. I think we can field those questions for sure. As like we normally do, BT, if you want to chime in while I'm answering or vice versa, let's do that. I guess for the one thing to mention about the BCR environment is that the temperature ranges are regulated or limited within them. That is, we may get a water source coming in that's groundwater, that's essentially or seepage water, and that may be at a temperature that's less than ambient, but the BCR itself has an insulating property, both in terms of the water and the media itself. So there aren't great swings in temperature within the BCR environment. If we see 5 degrees of centigrade of variation from inlet to outlet, that's a lot for these kind of systems. So generally, stay pretty constant or tracking generally the ambient temperature, but at a much more reduced range of fluctuation. We're generally seeing that temperature really doesn't play much of an effect unless it's at extremely cold ranges there, and then typically the approach there is to amplify the insulation of these systems and make sure there's enough of an insulating layer to conserve heat in the system. Regarding the ambient temperature at COLMAC, that range generally is from 5 to 25 degrees centigrade, so that's something like in the order of 40 degrees Fahrenheit up to below 90s, in the upper 80s, low 90s in that range. So it's a cool temperate, not necessarily warm temperate, but cool temperate environment. BT, did you want to add anything to the temperature first part there on the BCR?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, by burying these systems and insulating with a soil cover, that does certainly helps protect them in what we call very, very extreme cold climate environment. One thing to note is the Ferrous Haggerty mine in Montana. There was a pilot study that was done inside the mine. They were getting active sulfate reduction at about 4 degrees centigrade. The only reason the water wasn't really freezing is because it was so much TDS in the water was preventing it from freezing. But it was, you know, the temperatures really impact heterotrophic bacteria that tend to break down the organic matter and feed the sulfate reducers. And the sulfate reducers tend to be a little bit more resilient to temperature effects. So, we've operated these systems in extreme cold climate, and by burying them and maintaining them, it's we haven't really seen much of an issue we've been able to manage temperature.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me that, some of the sulfate bioreactor pilots we've done, there definitely is a temperature response. We'll see more sulfate reduction in the peak of the summer. This is at temperate latitudes here. But what's interesting is that even at the colder ranges, there's still activity, you know, and it's a matter of determining and sizing or designing these things is to estimate that rate at the coldest temperatures and confirm that it will still actually meet the criterion, whatever the parameter is. We don't see much of a selenium response. We do see some nitrate trends, but they're very mild compared to the sulfate, the effect of temperature and the sulfate reducers. I hope that answers the question for them, Michelle. If there's any further follow-up, please have them contact us, and we'll respond for further detail.
Okay, great. I will do. I think that sounded pretty clarifying to me. Got a couple questions about the metals that precipitate out of these systems. When you collect them, what do you do with them?
That's a good question. It's always a question. You know, you've got a bioreactor full of consolidated media, plus now you've spiced it up with these contaminants that are, thankfully out of the environment, but now you've got them in a more reduced or form. Several courses of action follow from that. One would be to either remove it, dry it out and remove it, and then take that to an environmental landfill if it does not pass the toxic contaminant leaching potential test. But that's one of your first stops, is really to assess the T-clip toxicity profile of that sequestered metal whatever the metal is. And that process is a more of a physically active leaching test, and it contains within that some thresholds that if the system produces a leachate or quality water or concentrate greater than the threshold, then it may be considered toxic and has to be disposed of. But our experience dealing with these is that we don't really see that potential happen so much. That is, we see these metals in bound and reduced or immobile forms. We don't often see that T-clip levels are exceeded or even approximated in these tests, indicating that you could dispose of this material in a regular landfill. But in the mine setting, my experience in BT, I'll just let you chime in here in a second. In the mine setting, there are options that may not exist elsewhere. That is, there may be it may be possible to build these bioreactors and essentially cap them in place, let them become their own new repository of this concentrated material over time. They could be supplemented with additional media on top, and thereby can kind of maintain the system as a bioreactor, but still continue to store it over a longer term. I think that there are probably other options too in that setting for disposal and consolidation. BT, did you want to add to that or get any more specifics or any thoughts that you've had on that?
Yeah, I think you covered it. We've done T-clips and total metals analysis on the majority of our pilot studies and projects. That's always a question that pops up, and clients are interested in. And when we start to decommission these barrels, they're always eager to take samples and try and evaluate. And we've been able to use that data to forward predict how much whether we think the substrate will pass T-clip in the future after a long period of accumulation.
But I guess just from the longevity question, the question is, well, is it sooner or later we're going to get to high levels, and then something has to be done with that media, And I think, generally speaking, some of these reactors really haven't been in place so long as to actually test that need. That is, we've done a great job here with our 10-year runs on these projects. That's why we're talking on the phone here today. We think that's a good sign, and no trends that it's going to be problematic. But there's still a long-term question of 20 years, 30 years, or 40 years. What would that be like? I think we know in the natural system, natural world, we'll see accumulations of metals for that go on for thousands of years, depending on the rate of accumulation. And that material is then sequestered in an inorganic or reduced form and may not be biologically available or even geologically available. It just essentially is in a sequestered. And so the question really remains is what happens after next on the mine setting or the future land use for that site. What really has to happen for that to change? It's not inconceivable to think about building wetlands that are actually maintaining that hydrated and anaerobic condition while still essentially sequestering those same constituents over the long term. So there are choices here on that one, Michelle.
Okay, great. Thank you, guys. We have a number more questions, so I guess I'll keep asking you. We have a participant that has, in general, wants to know how sensitive is the treatment efficiency of BCRs to hydraulic flow rate, and is there a risk of oversizing the cells?
Okay, I'll start that one because it speaks to some of the Colmac experience there, but other pilots bear on this too. I think the answer is there is a sensitivity, there is a response, and a lot depends on how rapidly that transient condition is applied. We'll see in pumped reactors where we're actually turning water off and on a daily basis in some of our pilots and full scales that we've investigated. In that case, you'll see a transient response, and I'm thinking of selenium here. That's probably our most recent experience like that. But thinking about that, we'll see if flows, for my example, could be doubled overnight. You might turn a pump on, and now you have twice the flow entering in a bioreactor. Hydraulically, most of these bioreactors have a sufficiently high hydraulic conductivity. They can take very high hydraulic loads. And because their volume, that they have a high porosity, they can absorb changes in flow pretty readily. But we do see that the biofilm, that is the microbial community that does a lot of the treatment, that will respond to a sudden change in loading. It's really not so much the hydraulic load as if it's, you know, flows that are too great or something disruptive about the flows. It's really the change in the load to that microbial biofilm that is providing the bulk of the treatment. And we'll see a transient effect where we may see a couple micrograms per liter in the form of, in the selenium case that I'm thinking of, where that bumps up a couple micrograms per liter, but then returns back to its normal steady state condition once that transient has happened, that is, the flow has changed. So there is some response, there is some sensitivity to that. So in that case, if it was a regulatory context where the concentration had to be kept within a certain range, pilots can show what that sensitivity is, and we've been able to do that as well in other pilot systems, showing that turning off and on, there is a transient response, but it returns back to normal within a day or two. They can also be managed by looking at what's causing that sudden change in flow or hydraulic loading. Is there a need for equalization up front to manage that or just to minimize it? But I think my main point here and my take on this, BT, is that there's it's a matter of the rate of change. If we can get that water delivered in a more more steady rate or somehow change the abruptness of that change in flow, then we'll see a far less transient response. But BT, do you want to add anything to that or amplify anything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, along the lines of, you know, we see a positive response to an increase in contaminant loading, but I think you touched on this. If the hydraulic loading becomes too great and we almost get like a dilutional effect of the contaminant load, that can be have a negative impact on the biofilms. It's not like they don't rebound, but it's, you know, we want to try and equalize that as much as possible.
No, it's true. It's not. That's right. Are we feeding them at the rate they've been growing and accustomed to, and they change, these flows will change. So I hope that answers the question. Surely there's a, when planning these projects, when the question always is, well, what's the flow rate? We're picking in these dynamic open systems like these stormwater or in these seepage water systems like we have at the coal mines. And usually there's a way to project what that maximum flow is, and there may be the potential to bypass the highest flows around the system or through some other process. At the Colmac site, we actually let that those high flows fill the different cells in series, and that provides a matter of storage before it overflows. So we actually get both treatment and both a surface storage as well as a downflow through the reactors. But that all has to be planned out and assessed through the available data or modeling that can be done. Like I say, I hope that answers the question. If there's more follow-up on that, Michelle, we'd be glad to respond to that, too.
Great. Thank you. We have another question about what contingencies and best management practices are used to maintain containment during rain events that overwhelm the capacity of the ponds.
What contingencies? So I suppose that speaks to what freeboard there may exist in the pond. Is there ability to absorb and let it stage up for a couple feet, depending on the size of the system, that could buy you some significant volume there. I think that's probably your first stop there, is to actually see to max out whatever is the available storage within the system, size it so that you could hold water on top of it. If it's a bioreactor, usually built in a downflow configuration, water's trickling through the bottom like BT's example showed, and it's possible to think about that extra flow as sitting on top of that reactor, and it's basically it's a pond, and letting it fill up on top of that, and let the outflow rate of the collector system and conveyance to the downstream cells regulate that flow out of that basin. Otherwise, we've seen, like in the case of at Mayor Ranch, we actually built a stormwater bypass around the whole system, so we would not get anything more than just the groundwater seepage, the artesian flow from the groundwater as the main source. BT,
yeah,
you wanna,
I was going to add, one of the critical factors in designing these things is keeping clean water clean and trying to manage flow. This is beyond the scope of this talk, but looking at something like a Goldstem water balance type analysis of a site to try and determine, like, where can we either keep water out of the mine pool to try and, dampen the overall effects and try and minimize the big slugs that we get from, say, a freshet or a storm event. We can also look at ways of building large capacity equalization basins that would take, it would almost be like a stormwater capture system, allow the slug of water coming, of impacted water coming through the system to, capture it and slowly bleed it off into the to the passive treatment system, either through solar pumping or through natural valve control and reduced throttle back flow control. We've also looked at, trying to retain water back up in the mine pool and then slowly release it. Of course, you don't want a whole lot of fluctuation in the water levels in your mine pool, so you don't get a lot of oxidation reduction bouncing along that boundary and form secondary salt that can be very acidic.
So I guess, Michelle, there's a list of responses there that, may vary depending on the situation that the questioner has, but hope that's responsive, and we can also respond to any of these things in more detail as needed.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I think just really quickly, we can take one more question with a quick-ish response. And I think I'm going to ask one about the cost because we got a couple questions about that. We got a very specific question. I guess you presented some data about a cost of less than 1 cent per 1,000 gallon. And I guess there was a question as to whether that included the construction cost. And then more generally, when you talk about the O&M cost, does that include the monitoring of what's precipitating out of the system?
Okay.
The 10% per 1,000 gallon cost that we calculate for Mayor Ranch is based on the annual O&M of just less than $10,000 per year. It doesn't include the capital cost. It's just the O&M cost, and when we compare that to our active treatment system, we looked at active annual O&M and we kept the capital expenditure out of the equation, but it certainly can be factored in. And that cost does include not only operation maintenance but also monitoring, especially for Mayor Ranch, and I believe also that was the value we got from Terry for Colmac, the $5,000.
Yeah, and I'd say that the questioner is on the right track here because, you can look at the cost, amortized cost of the total construction and, a 20-year or 30-year monitoring or maintenance cost to get to a long-term cost, and that usually is the kind of comparisons we'll do side-by-side when looking at active technologies. And as And I'm quick to say that natural treatment or passive treatment approaches don't fit every situation. We've tried to indicate here a couple times that sometimes the land area is just not available, sometimes the flows are so great, sometimes the residual production is so great that you need a mechanized or industrialized type system to handle it here. But if we're in the low flow range here, 100, less than 1,000 gallons per minute, it's always something to consider because of the relatively lower annual O&M cost of the labor and attached to that. So the cost for the Mayer Ranch project was, in total, based on the grants back then, was like $1.1 million for that system. And that is, so far, has we've seen very little changes structurally needed to the site. So the long-term, perspective for that project is that will last another 10, 20 years easily, if not longer, for comparison. I hope does that answer, do you think those answered the questions there?
Yes, I do. Michelle? I think that answers the questions very well. Thank you. And I want to thank both of you for such an excellent presentation and the level of detail. It's definitely appreciated by our audience, and that was shown by the level of participation that we received from them, too. So thank you to all the participants. At this point, I think I'd like to turn it over to Gene Ballant to close out the session and let you know where you can get more information about these types of webinars.
All right, great. Thank you so much. I'll just walk through a few quick reminders here before we close out today's live broadcast. Remember, if you're interested in participating in these types of free online trainings, we encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluein.org. We also send out a monthly newsletter called Tech Direct on the first of each month. You're welcome to subscribe to that newsletter, as well as a number of others that we offer in the area of hazardous waste site cleanup. So we encourage you to connect with us and follow us to find out our latest events as they become scheduled. If you're looking for a complete copy of the presentation materials and their resources, you'll find that on the additional resources or seminar links page. I've included a link to that on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. And then if you're looking for contact information for our presenters and organizers, we've also shared that as well. Although, as noted, it sounds like the presenters welcome additional follow-on questions should you have something that we weren't able to get to live today. I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. Again, you'll find that under the related URLs on the middle right. Please know I read each and every submission that comes in, and it helps us to continue to deliver these free sessions through the Cleanup Information Network. If you fill out that online feedback form, there's a box you can check at the very bottom of the form to certify you are here for the whole session. And immediately upon submitting your feedback, you'll have access to a participation certificate that you can save for your own records. I often get asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our seminars. While we don't issue those credit hours, many of our participants are still able to document their participation using the registration emails, copies of the materials, and these types of certificates for participating with their own accrediting institution to get credit. If you happen to be one of the people joining as a group from one location under someone else's registration, it's okay. As long as that person who registered sends you the seminar feedback form link, you can each fill out the feedback form on your own to get your own participation certificate, even though you may not have independently registered. And for those of you that happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's archived webinars, you can still follow those links to the feedback form to share your thoughts of the recorded version and get a participation certificate. And so with that, I want to echo Michelle's thanks to our presenters and organizers, as well as the live audience who joined us today. We had people from actually all over the U.S., as well as a number of other international participants. So again, we hope that you found this a valuable expenditure of time, and we'll hear